Chapter 2. Unending Attacks. I have endured all shame and blame, and I have lived these down. Mary Baker Eddy, 1901. Emperor William of Germany made a hasty trip to England in the first month of the new century, requesting that his arrival be given no official notice. He was rushing to the bedside of his beloved grandmother, Queen Victoria, who passed away Tuesday evening, January 22nd. The press reported, "When the word was sent out that the Queen was dying, her grandson, Emperor William of Germany, was one of the first to hasten to her bedside. He desired that no official notice be taken of his arrival, as he wished to be received merely as a grandson. His unaffected love for the Queen and sorrow for her loss has endeared the Emperor to the hearts of the British people and won for him the enhanced regard of all persons who loved the English Queen. All the world lamented the loss of the much-loved British monarch. Mrs. Eddy wrote from Pleasant View to her church in Boston, January 27, 1901. Mr. Benjamin Johnson, CSB, Clerk. Beloved student, I deem it proper that the Mother Church in Boston, Massachusetts, the first church of Christian Science known on earth, should upon this solemn occasion congregate, that a special meeting of the first members convene for the sacred purpose of expressing our deep sympathy with the bereaved nation, its loss, and the world's loss, in the sudden departure of the late lamented Victoria, Queen of Great Britain and Empress of India, long honored, revered, beloved, quote, God save the Queen, end quote, is heard no more in England, but this shout of love lives on in the hearts of millions. With love, Mary Baker G. Eddy." The meeting was held on January 31st, where resolutions of deepest sympathy were adopted and conveyed to the British government. At the suggestion of Mr. Orman Higman of Canada, the American and British flags were flown at half-mast at Pleasant View on February 2nd, the day of Victoria's funeral. Newspapers around the world devoted much space to Queen Victoria, her life, her reign, her husband, her children, especially her oldest son, Albert Edward, who was now King Edward VII. On this side of the Atlantic, events of great moment were transpiring, although few were truly interested in them, and perhaps only one in all the world was aware of their import. The momentous question first came to public notice in January of 1895, right after the dedication of the Mother Church in Boston. Mrs. Laura Lathrop gave a statement to reporters, which caused them to request an interview with Mrs. Eddy to answer whether she was the second Christ. Mrs. Eddy preferred to answer the query in writing, which she did, telegraphing her response to the New York Herald on February 4th, 1895. Pulpit and Press, page 74. Her answer was very similar to that of Jesus in Matthew. Quote, Why callest thou me good? There is none good but one. End quote. This satisfied friend and foe alike, but it did not silence the issue. Mrs. Eddy's communion address to the Mother Church in 1899, Miscellany, page 124, which she has titled, quote, Purification of the Church, end quote, stated that, quote, the doom of the Babylonish woman, referred to in Revelation, is being fulfilled, end quote. Mrs. Josephine Woodbury saw herself as the Babylonish woman, despite Mrs. Eddy's repeated efforts to rouse her from this dream. Mrs. Woodbury also saw, far more clearly than most, that Mrs. Eddy's life of purity was the fulfillment of the prophecy and revelation of the woman, God crowned. This was the main accusation against Mrs. Eddy that Josephine Woodbury poured into mortal thought with scorn, that Mrs. Eddy considered herself the woman of the apocalypse. The impurity in mortal consciousness picked up Mrs. Woodbury's scorn and hurled it about. One minister in Raleigh, North Carolina, in a sermon attacking Mrs. Eddy and Christian Science late in 1900, stated, quote, add to this the doctrine that Mrs. Eddy herself is the highest expression of the divine idea in the human form, surpassing Jesus as he surpassed Moses, and you have, in brief, the doctrine of Christian Science, end quote. There was more truth than fiction in the minister's words, but the right thing at the wrong time ceases to be right. The world was not ready for this revelation. Only spiritualized thought can perceive spirituality. So the refutation of the attack by Alfred Farlow, Publication Committee, stated, quote, this is as far from Christian Science as night from day, and there is nothing in the writings of Mrs. Eddy to warrant such assumption. Mrs. Eddy claims absolutely nothing for her personality, except that she is the discoverer and founder of Christian Science. End quote. Farlow was right about her claiming nothing for her personality. However, the paragraphs interpreting the parable of the woman leavening the three measures of meal had been in the chapter, quote, Science, Theology, Medicine, end quote, in Science and Health, since the 50th edition in 1891. The second paragraph then, as now, stated, did not this parable point a moral with a prophecy, foretelling the second appearing in the flesh of the Christ truth, hidden in sacred secrecy from the visible world? At the time of the Woodbury lawsuit, that passage in Science and Health was changed to read, quote, on the flesh, end quote, in place of in the flesh. Christ's second appearing needed to be hidden a little longer, quote, from the visible world, end quote. It also needed to be protected from its friends as much as from its foes. Their zealous enthusiasm would no doubt rouse the world's antagonism and jeopardize the cause and the court case. Many a battle had been lost for lack of wisdom or discretion on the part of her own soldiers. Mrs. Eddy's spiritual identity as the second coming of the Christ had been revealed to two of her disciples, Ira Oscar Knapp, and Septimus J. Hanna, and they had shared it with many others. But now they were the two who most needed to guard everything they said in order to protect this divine revelation from being torn asunder. What all had to meet every day was the unending attacks emanating from Mrs. Woodbury. And Mrs. Eddy seemed to be the only one undeceived by the malicious lies on every front. One very sad instance had occurred in 1899 and involved the enthusiastic new convert to Christian Science, Colonel Oliver Sabin. He had begun devoting his publication, the Washington Newsletter, to the promotion of Christian Science. Not only was malicious malpractice aimed at Sabin to poison his thought against Mrs. Eddy and her cause, but a similar malpractice was directed to the first members to poison their thought against Colonel Sabin. Sadly, the first members did not refute the wicked suggestions, and when Oliver Sabin applied for membership, his application was rejected. When Mrs. Eddy learned of it, she tried to patch up the fissure and save this new student, as her letter to him clearly indicates. It comes to me that I ought to inform you of how I heard the first ill word of you. It came thus. I knew you had applied for church membership, but on reading the list of new members, missed your name. Wrote to my church to know why. Received no reply. And then wrote to a person that you had written to me was your friend to learn of him. The answer shocked me. I commenced doing what I could for you all, and the result I enclose herewith. I see it is one person that is moving in all this to harm you and become a contributor to your paper and to revenge for being excommunicated from probation in our church after I had done all in my power to reform her, and she had confessed to me her crime, yet not one half her guilt, and I had at last to withdraw my support from her. She claims to have been my favorite. That was her tale. She never was one I could love, but I helped her all the same. Her next move will be to cause you to admit into your paper articles not genuine and to pass them as such. Beware. God help you. Mother. Though she wrote, quote, she never was one I could love, end quote, the leader gave more true love to Mrs. Woodbury than did all the world combined, as is evident in a letter Mrs. Woodbury wrote on March 11th, 1895. Do you know, way off in that pure realm where you dwell, that the sharpest sting I feel is the awful sense of what your disappointment in me is? You say there is a promise of joy ahead if I will trust the dear mother to guide me, and if I try to do right steadily. But can that love prevent me from bearing this anguish of regret even to the end? Even now, when you know I ought to bear every pang alone without a hint of help from you, and bear it all, and without complaint, you come with your soft wing and bear me up, lest I fail utterly. You know I could have borne rebuke better than this letting out of your love upon me. In her letter to Oliver Sabin, Mrs. Eddy had probably included the bylaw, Alertness to Duty, Manual, page 42. That is what she had done at that time, and is most likely what was referred to in her sentence. Quote, I commenced doing what I could for you all, and the result I enclose herewith. End quote. But Colonel Sabin had no understanding of malicious animal magnetism, and the damage had been done. Evil always attributes its own wicked ways to the righteous, or endeavors so to do, and that was the thrust of Josephine Woodbury's attacks against Christian Scientists, which were being spread all over the country. An editorial in Austin, Texas, stated in part, quote, Christian Scientists contend there is no limit to their influence. Their efforts to coerce the surrogate by their mental treatment illustrates a phase or side of Eddyism to which little attention has been paid. Eddyism is precisely the same thing as voodooism, and the followers of the new cult, like those of the older one, believe that they can injure as well as aid, can punish enemies as well as reward friends. End quote. An answer from a local scientist refuting all the misstatements with quotations from Science and Health was published in the Austin Daily Tribune. The writer exonerated the Tribune by noting that their editorial, quote, Christian Scientists in Court, end quote, was largely quoted from the New York Times. The Times article quoted was in relation to the Brush Will case, then going on in New York City. Miss Helen C. Brush had bequeathed about $75,000 to Mrs. Stetson's church, First Church of Christ Scientist, New York City. Two members of Miss Brush's family contested the will, although the other members desired the provisions to be carried out. An article entitled, quote, Christian Science Healing Explained and Defended, end quote, was written especially for the New York Sunday Journal by Mrs. Eddy, quote, in answer to charges made in the famous Brush Will Contest in the New York court, end quote. The first half of the lengthy article appears in Miscellany, page 219 to 222, with the exception of these paragraphs. That a lawsuit was contemplated or in progress before Surrogate Fitzgerald in New York City was unknown to me until very recently, having read a report of it through the press. I have never issued orders of any sort relative to the presiding surrogate in the Brush case. What is alleged to be Miss Brush's statement, namely, quote, it is impossible for me to die, end quote, simply reiterated the declarations of our Lord, who said, quote, if a man keep my saying, he shall never see death, end quote, and, quote, daughter, be of good comfort. Thy faith hath made thee whole. Go in peace, end quote. The great master knew that faith in God, who is our life, is not insanity, whereas lack of charity may be a species of insanity. The second half of this article was quotations from Science and Health, which are well worth studying for elucidation on, quote, healing explained and defended, end quote. They are pages 113, lines 9 to 25, page 143, lines 5 to 12, page 153, line 16, to page 154, line 9. Page 157, line 8, to 158, line 23. And page 98, line 15 to 21. All of the foregoing quotations in the 1901 Science and Health are essentially the same in the latest edition. However, the closing paragraph in the article for the New York Journal was changed from the one in Science and Health, page 98, to close the article thus: beyond the frail premises of human hypotheses, above the loosening grasp of creeds, the demonstrations of Christian Science stand revealed as practical science. Divine metaphysics is Christ Jesus' revelation of truth and love, for which he labored and suffered, then left a legacy to mankind, and which remains the divine standard for the understanding and practice of every man. The court battle over Miss Brush's will was a fierce one, aimed mainly at ridiculing and destroying Christian Science and the leader's most prominent disciple, Augusta Stetson. It was a miniature, if not an unrecognized part, of the Woodbury case in Boston, attempting to eliminate Mrs. Eddy's strongest helper by accusing her of fraud and attempting to discredit her cause by alleging that Christian Scientists were insane. The noted alienist, Dr. Alan McLean Hamilton, was called to testify and was asked, quote, do you say that a person who believes in the power of God operating through a human agent to cure disease without material means suffers from delusions? Yes, he answered, most decidedly, end quote. The New York World telegraphed the substance of Dr. Hamilton's testimony to Mrs. Eddy in Concord and requested a reply. Mrs. Eddy's response, miscellany, page 301, appeared in the New York World of February 24th, 1901. Concord, New Hampshire, February 22nd. To the editor of the World. Is faith in divine metaphysics insanity? All sin is insanity, but healing the sick is not sin. There is a universal insanity which mistakes fable for fact throughout the entire testimony of the material senses. Those unfortunate people who are committed to insane asylums are only so many well-defined instances of the baneful effects of illusion on mortal minds and bodies. The supposition that we can correct insanity by the use of drugs is in itself a species of insanity. A drug cannot of itself go to the brain or affect cerebral conditions in any manner whatever. Drugs cannot remove inflammation, restore disordered functions, or destroy disease without the aid of mind. If mind be absent from the body, drugs can produce no curative effect upon it. mind must be, is, the vehicle of all modes of healing disease and of producing disease. Through the mandate of mind, or according to his belief, a man can be helped or he can be killed by a drug. But mind, not matter, produces the result in either case. Neither life nor death, health nor disease, can be produced on a corpse, whence mind has departed. This self-evident fact is proof that mind is the cause of all effect, made manifest through so-called matter. The general craze is that matter masters mind. The specific insanity is that brain, matter, is insane. Mary Baker G. Eddy. This court trial resulted in a victory for the Christian Scientists. In his lengthy decision, published in the Christian Science Journal of October 1901, volume 19, pages 455 to 467, Surrogate Fitzgerald stated, "So far as concerns Mrs. Stetson, I am convinced that she was entirely innocent of the fraud that has been sought to be fastened upon her." On the 28th of February, Mrs. Stetson wrote in a letter to one of her students, "The Brushwill case has been a fierce mental battle from which I have emerged with the proof of honesty and truth written in the history of the courts. I am weary, but have no time to rest from active duty. My hands are torn, but I have no time to bind them up. The dear love must heal them while I go to others and pour in oil and heal the brokenhearted. I must forget self and labor for others." Mrs. Stetson was so occupied with battles of her own that she was little aware of the intensity of the attacks Mrs. Eddy was having to meet. In his home in Vermont, Foster Eddy was reading the newspaper accounts of the lawsuit against his adopted mother and wrote her on February 28th of his loyal support, also stating, quote, "Be careful, dear one. You are surrounded by vipers. Shake them off and put your whole trust in God." End quote. In February, Calvin Fry recorded in his diary, "Mrs. Eddy said at supper table today, 'If I do not live to see this lawsuit of W's finished, I can say this. Calvin has helped me to live many years.'" Mrs. Eddy was daily directing the mental workers in her home with watches, such as this one of February 15th, preserved by Lewis Strang. "Mother sends you this message. Rise up and defeat the evil one in the gates. The hour of deliverance is at hand, and all must do their duty as Christian Scientists to defeat the evil that tries to find entrance here. Love, mind, truth, rule this and every hour. Error is not met by prayer alone, but by fasting." While rising up to defeat the evil that tries to find entrance here, and instructing and inspiring her students to do the same, the leader was daily watching over her flock and her cause, guiding, guarding, directing, encouraging, mothering. In January, she had had the first members turn over their powers to the board of directors On March 7th, a new bylaw was published. Quote, "Each Church of Christ Scientist shall have its own form of government. No conference of churches shall be held." End quote. Later, this was titled, quote, "Local Self-Government," end quote. Manual, page 70. On March 18th, young Bliss Knapp was made a first member at Mrs. Eddy's request. The 21st of March saw an amended bylaw for those whose teachers have left them. Also, quote, "something new," end quote. All churches from this date are requested to read the Scientific Statement of Being and 1 John chapter 3, verses 1 through 3, at the close of service. On the same date, the following message went out to all the field. Beloved brethren, all over our land, and in every land, accept Mother's spring greeting, while the bird of hope is singing a lightsome lay, a cooing call, and in her heart is beating a love for all. 'Tis peace, not power, I seek. 'Tis meet that man be meek. On April 4th, the leader wrote a message to Second Church Chicago, Miscellany, page 191. While the watch for her household mental workers that day was, "Watchfulness is the word of this hour of trial for our cause. Keep apart from the Sunday students in our midst who trample his divine word underfoot all week and expect forgiveness on the Sabbath. Their reward awaits them." A message to Second Church, New York, was written on April 5th, Miscellany, page 201. A thank you for Easter gifts on April 13th. And on April 25th, her, quote, "word to the wise," end quote, Miscellany, page 223, was published in the Sentinel. While all this and much more was going on, Mrs. Woodbury was working just as assiduously pouring, quote, "wormwood into the waters, the disturbed human mind, to drown the strong swimmer struggling for the shore, aiming for truth, and if possible, to poison such as drink of the living water," end quote. As the court date drew nearer, Josephine Woodbury and her attorney, Frederick Peabody, held repeated conferences with students who had deserted and betrayed their leader, from Richard Kennedy to William G. Nixon to Judge Clarkson, and at the same time, Mrs. Woodbury intensified her bombardment of the leader with poisonous and deadly suggestions. On the 17th of April, Calvin Fry wrote to Mr. Kimball of the effect this malicious mental malpractice had on Mrs. Eddy. "She is literally living in agony from day to day, waiting to have this case called up and disposed of. And W is pouring in her hot shot, declaring she cannot live through the ordeal. Despite the agony and intensity of her suffering, the leader kept at her post, continuing with her work, guiding her flock." At that time, she was writing her message to the Mother Church for 1901. She also called upon the metaphysical workers in her home to support her in her work. Calvin Fry and Clara Shannon were veterans in this department and had been through many a battle with their leader. But this was a new experience for Joseph Mann. One day, when the message for 1901 was about half finished, Clara felt the insidious wickedness that was striking at Mrs. Eddy's life and was doing her utmost to counteract it. Miss Shannon was keeping her watch in another room, and Calvin Fry and Joseph Mann were with Mother, who was having a struggle, as Miss Shannon knew. She could hear the two men talking with Mother, and Miss Shannon was praying to God, sometimes on her knees, for life and strength, truth and love to be manifested there, for Miss Shannon felt something awful was approaching mentally. Finally, the sound of the men's voices ceased. Miss Shannon said she heard that silence. It was the most awful sound she had ever heard. She went into Mother's room, and there lay Calvin Fry and Joseph Mann, stretched on the floor, flat on their faces. Then she looked at Mother. Her head had dropped, her jaw dropped, and every sign of death. Miss Shannon shouted truth at her, shook her, called her, quoted the book Science and Health, reminded her that Mother had written this book. Finally, consciousness began to return, and Miss Shannon told her to stand on her feet, and putting her hands under Mother's armpits, held her up, a dead weight. Finally and suddenly, Mother laughed. Miss Shannon looked up and gave thanks when she heard this and asked what the laugh meant. Mother said, "Your face, if you could see your face, you would laugh too." Mrs. Eddy picked up her pad of paper and continued her writing as if nothing had happened, which was not as easy for Clara Shannon to do. She returned to her room across the hall, but left the door ajar and kept looking in on Mother quietly. After two or three times, Mrs. Eddy rebuked her, saying sharply, "Go and handle your fear. You are afraid I shall have another attack. Go and handle your own fear." In her earnest intensiveness, Miss Shannon had become unconscious of the unconscious men on the floor and knew not when they recovered and departed. When the message was completed, Mrs. Eddy said to Miss Shannon, "Oh, what a lot of love it took to do that. The mesmerists did not want the world to have that message, but love meant it to be given." She also told Clara that the 1901 message was Christian Science in a nutshell. But before completing her message, she had another concern. Joseph Mann had disappeared. He wrote later that he had been driven to distraction by his inability to meet the demands made upon him. Joseph had sought refuge in his brother's home in Boston. When Mrs. Eddy did not find him at Christian Science Hall in Concord, she asked Mrs. Baker to find him for her. On May 1st, Joseph wrote to Mrs. Eddy, "I felt I must hide myself a few days, and so Mrs. Baker found me in Brother's quiet home. God bless you, and I thank you for sending Mrs. Baker to have me come back. I could at once see how I could be helpful at the cottage at this time, however sad my failures at the house have been. For though I have kept it from you, dear mother, the cottage and August, in his general management, have needed my constant support. On the envelope to this letter, Mrs. Eddy penned the words, "Sad, sad." But to Joseph she wrote, "Mother was glad when you returned, and would have run out and met you if she were used to running. Now be happy in the memory of what a good son you have been to Mother. Think of how many times you have comforted her, and how you came to Concord only to help her. After Jesus' temptation in the wilderness, angels ministered unto him. Remain near me if you are willing, and if you are in the cottage, I can call for you in need."